or really let the matter drop, was the question that worried him all the way. He thought angrily of the pleasure he would have at seeing the fright of that small and frail but proud man when covered by his pistol. And then he felt with surprise that of all the men he knew, there was none he would so much like to have for a friend as that very adjutant whom he so hated. Chapter 7. The Emperor Reviews the Army. Enthusiasm of Nicholas. The day after Rostov had been to see Boris, a review was held of the Austrian and Russian troops, both those freshly arrived from Russia and those who had been campaigning under Kutuzov. The two emperors, the Russian with his heir the Tsarevich and the Austrian with the Archduke, inspected the allied army of 80,000 men. From early morning, the smart, clean troops were on the move, forming up on the field before the fortress. Now thousands of feet and bayonets moved and halted at the officer's command, turned with banners flying, formed up at intervals, and wheeled round other similar masses of infantry in different uniforms. Now was heard the rhythmic beat of hoofs and the jingling of showy cavalry in blue, red, and green braided uniforms, with smartly dressed bandsmen in front mounted on black, roan, or grey horses. Then again, spreading out with the brazen clatter of the polished, shining cannon that quivered on the gun carriages, and with the smell of linstocks, came the artillery, which crawled between the infantry and cavalry and took up its appointed position. Not only the generals in full parade uniforms with their thin or thick waists drawn in to the utmost, their red necks squeezed into their stiff collars and wearing scarves and all their decorations, not only the elegant pomaded officers, but every soldier with his freshly washed and shaven face and his weapons clean and polished to the utmost, and every horse groomed till its coat shone like satin and every hair of its wetted mane lay smooth, felt that no small matter was happening, but an important and solemn affair. Every general and every soldier was conscious of his own insignificance, aware of being but a drop in that ocean of men, and yet at the same time was conscious of his strength as a part of that enormous whole. From early morning, strenuous activities and efforts had begun, and by 10 o'clock all had been brought into due order. The ranks were drawn up on the vast field. The whole army was extended in three lines, the cavalry in front, behind it the artillery, and behind that again the infantry. A space like a street was left between each two lines of troops. The three parts of that army were sharply distinguished. Kutuzov's fighting army, with the Pavlograds on the right flank of the front, those recently arrived from Russia, both guards and regiments of the line, and the Austrian troops. But they all stood in the same lines under one command and in a like order. Like wind over leaves ran an excited whisper, "They're coming! They're coming!" Alarmed voices were heard, and a stir of final preparation swept over all the troops. From the direction of Olmütz in front of them, a group was seen approaching. And at that moment, though the day was still, a light gust of wind blowing over the army slightly stirred the streamers on the lances, and the unfolded standards fluttered against their staffs. It looked as if, by that slight motion, the army itself was expressing its joy at the approach of the emperors. One voice was heard shouting, "Eyes front!" Then, like the crowing of cocks at sunrise, this was repeated by others from various sides, and all became silent. In the death-like stillness, only the tramp of horses was heard. This was the emperor's suites. The emperors rode up to the flank, and the trumpets of the 1st Cavalry Regiment played the general march. It seemed as though not the trumpeters were playing, but as if the army itself, rejoicing at the emperor's approach, had naturally burst into music. Amid these sounds, only the youthful, kindly voice of the Emperor Alexander was clearly heard. He gave the words of greeting, and the 1st Regiment roared hurrah so deafeningly, continuously, and joyfully that the men themselves were awed by their multitude and the immensity of the power they constituted. Rostov, standing in the front lines of Kutuzov's army, which the Tsar approached first, experienced the same feeling as every other man in that army, a feeling of self-forgetfulness, a proud consciousness of might, and a passionate attraction to him who was the cause of this triumph. He felt that at a single word from that man, all this vast mass, and he himself an insignificant atom in it, would go through fire and water, commit crime, die, or perform deeds of highest heroism. And so he could not but tremble, and his heart stand still at the imminence of that word. "Hurrah! Hurrah! Hurrah!" thundered from all sides, one regiment after another, greeting the Tsar with the strains of the march. And then, "Hurrah!" Then the general march, and again, "Hurrah! Hurrah!" growing ever stronger and fuller, and merging into a deafening roar. Till the Tsar reached it, each regiment in its silence and immobility seemed like a lifeless body. But as soon as he came up, it became alive, its thunder joining the roar of the whole line along which he had already passed. Through the terrible and deafening roar of those voices, amid the square masses of troops standing motionless as if turned to stone, hundreds of riders composing the suites moved carelessly but symmetrically, and above all freely, and in front of them two men, the emperors. Upon them the undivided, tensely passionate attention of that whole mass of men was concentrated. The handsome young Emperor Alexander, in the uniform of the Horse Guards, wearing a cocked hat with its peaks front and back, with his pleasant face and resonant, though not loud, voice, attracted everyone's attention. Rostop was not far from the trumpeters, and with his keen sight had recognized the Tsar and watched his approach. When he was within 20 paces, and Nicholas could clearly distinguish every detail of his handsome, happy young face, he experienced a feeling of tenderness and ecstasy such as he had never before known. Every trait and every movement of the Tsar's seemed to him enchanting. Stopping in front of the Pavlograds, the Tsar said something in French to the Austrian emperor and smiled. Seeing that smile, Rostov involuntarily smiled himself and felt a still stronger flow of love for his sovereign. He longed to show that love in some way, and knowing that this was impossible, was ready to cry. The Tsar called the colonel of the regiment and said a few words to him. "Oh, God, what would happen to me if the emperor spoke to me?" thought Rostov. "I should die of happiness." The Tsar addressed the officers also. "I thank you all, gentlemen. I thank you with my whole heart." To Rostov, every word sounded like a voice from heaven. How gladly would he have died at once for his Tsar. "You have earned the St. George's standards and will be worthy of them." Oh, to die for him, thought Rostov. The Tsar said something more, which Rostov did not hear, and the soldiers, straining their lungs, shouted, "Hurrah!" Rostov, too, bending over his saddle, shouted "Hurrah!" with all his might, feeling that he would like to injure himself by that shout, if only to express his rapture fully. The Tsar stopped a few minutes in front of the hussars, as if undecided. "How can the emperor be undecided?" thought Rostov. But then even this indecision appeared to him majestic and enchanting, like everything else the Tsar did. That hesitation lasted only an instant. The Tsar's foot, in the narrow pointed boot then fashionable, touched the groin of the bob-tailed bay mare he rode. His hand in a white glove gathered up the reins, and he moved off accompanied by an irregularly swaying sea of aides-de-camp. Farther and farther he rode away, stopping at other regiments, till at last only his white plumes were visible to Rostov from amid the suites that surrounded the emperor's. Among the gentlemen of the suite, Rostov noticed Bolkonski sitting his horse indolently and carelessly. Rostov recalled their quarrel of yesterday, and the question presented itself whether he ought or ought not to challenge Bolkonski. "Of course not," he now thought. "Is it worth thinking or speaking of it at such a moment? At a time of such love, such rapture, and such self-sacrifice, what do any of our quarrels and affronts matter? I love and forgive everybody now." When the emperor had passed nearly all the regiments, the troops began a ceremonial march past him, and Rostov on Bedwin, recently purchased from Denisov, rode past too at the rear of his squadron, that is, alone and in full view of the Emperor. Before he reached him, Rostov, who was a splendid horseman, spurred Bedwin twice and successfully put him to the showy trot in which the animal went when excited. Bending his foaming muzzle to his chest, his tail extended, Bedwin, as if also conscious of the Emperor's eye upon him, passed splendidly, lifting his feet with a high and graceful action, as if flying through the air without touching the ground. Rostov himself, his legs well back and his stomach drawn in, and feeling himself one with his horse, rode past the Emperor with a frowning but blissful face. Like a very devil, as Denisov expressed it. Fine fellows, the Pavlograds, remarked the Emperor. My God, how happy I should be if he ordered me to leap into the fire this instant, thought Rostov. When the review was over, the newly arrived officers, and also Kutuzov's, collected in groups and began to talk about the awards, about the Austrians and their uniforms, about their lines, about Bonaparte, and how badly the latter would fare now, especially if the Essen Corps arrived and Prussia took our side. But the talk in every group was chiefly about the Emperor Alexander. His every word and movement was described with ecstasy. They all had but one wish, to advance as soon as possible against the enemy under the Emperor's command. Commanded by the Emperor himself, they could not fail to vanquish anyone, be it whom it might. So thought Rostov and most of the officers after the review. All were then more confident of victory than the winning of two battles would have made them. Chapter 8. Boris visits Prince Andrew at Olmütz. Prince Dolgorukov. The day after the review, Boris, in his best uniform and with his comrade Berg's best wishes for success, rode to Olmütz to see Bolkonski, wishing to profit by his friendliness and obtain for himself the best post he could, preferably that of adjutant to some important personage, a position in the army which seemed to him most attractive. It is all very well for Rostov, whose father sends him 10,000 rubles at a time, to talk about not wishing to cringe to anybody and not be anyone's lackey. But I, who have nothing but my brains, have to make a career and must not miss opportunities, but must avail myself of them, he reflected. He did not find Prince Andrew in Olmütz that day, but the appearance of the town where the headquarters and the diplomatic corps were stationed and the two emperors were living with their suites, households, and courts only strengthened his desire to belong to that higher world. He knew no one, and despite his smart guardsman's uniform, all these exalted personages passing in the streets in their elegant carriages with their plumes, ribbons, and medals, both courtiers and military men, seemed so immeasurably above him, an insignificant officer of the guards, that they not only did not wish to, but simply could not be aware of his existence. At the quarters of the commander-in-chief, Kutuzov, where he inquired for Bolkonski, all the adjutants and even the orderlies looked at him as if they wished to impress on him that a great many officers like him were always coming there, and that everybody was heartily sick of them. In spite of this, or rather because of it, next day, November 15th, after dinner, he again went to Olmütz, and entering the house occupied by Kutuzov, asked for Bolkonski. Prince Andrew was in, and Boris was shown into a large hall probably formerly used for dancing, but in which five beds now stood, and furniture of various kinds, a table, chairs, and a clavichord. One adjutant nearest the door was sitting at the table in a Persian dressing gown writing. Another, the red stout Nyesvitsky, lay on a bed with his arms under his head, laughing with an officer who had sat down beside him. A third was playing a Viennese waltz on the clavichord, while a fourth, lying on the clavichord, sang the tune. Bolkonski was not there. None of these gentlemen changed his position on seeing Boris. The one who was writing, and whom Boris addressed, turned round crossly and told him Bolkonski was on duty, and that he should go through the door on the left into the reception room if he wished to see him. Boris thanked him and went to the reception room, where he found some 10 officers and generals. When he entered, Prince Andrew, his eyes drooping contemptuously with that peculiar expression of polite weariness which plainly says, "If it were not my duty, I would not talk to you for a moment," was listening to an old Russian general with decorations who stood very erect, almost on tiptoe, with a soldier's obsequious expression on his purple face, reporting something. "Very well, then, be so good as to wait," said Prince Andrew to the general in Russian, speaking with the French intonation he affected when he wished to speak contemptuously. And noticing Boris, Prince Andrew, paying no more heed to the general, who ran after him imploring him to hear something more, nodded and turned to him with a cheerful smile. At that moment, Boris clearly realized what he had before surmised, that in the army, besides the subordination and discipline prescribed in the military code, which he and the others knew in the regiment, there was another, more important subordination, which made this tight-laced, purple-faced general wait respectfully while Captain Prince Andrew, for his own pleasure, chose to chat with Lieutenant Drubetskoy. More than ever was Boris resolved to serve in future not according to the written code, but under this unwritten law. He felt now that merely by having been recommended to Prince Andrew, he had already risen above the general who at the front had the power to annihilate him, a lieutenant of the guards. Prince Andrew came up to him and took his hand. "I'm very sorry you did not find me in yesterday. I was fussing about with Germans all day. We went with Weyrother to survey the dispositions. When Germans start being accurate, there's no end to it." Boris smiled, as if he understood what Prince Andrew was alluding to as something generally known. But it was the first time he had heard Weyrother's name, or even the term dispositions. "Well, my dear fellow, so you still want to be an adjutant? I've been thinking about you." "Yes, I was thinking," for some reason Boris could not help blushing, "of asking the commander-in-chief. He has had a letter from Prince Kuragin about me. I only wanted to ask because I fear the guards won't be in action," he added as if in apology. All right, we'll talk it over," replied Prince Andrew. "Only let me report this gentleman's business, and I shall be at your disposal." While Prince Andrew went to report about the purple-faced general, that gentleman, evidently not sharing Boris's conception of the advantages of the unwritten code of subordination, looked so fixedly at the presumptuous lieutenant who had prevented his finishing what he had to say to the adjutant that Boris felt uncomfortable. He turned away and waited impatiently for Prince Andrew's return from the commander-in-chief's room. "You see, my dear fellow, I've been thinking about you," said Prince Andrew, when they had gone into the large room where the clavichord was. "It's no use your going to the commander-in-chief. He would say a lot of pleasant things, ask you to dinner. That would not be bad as regards the unwritten code," thought Boris. "But nothing more would come of it. There will soon be a battalion of us aides-de-camp and adjutants. But this is what we'll do. I have a good friend, an adjutant-general, and an excellent fellow, Prince Dolgorukov. And though you may not know it, the fact is that now Kutuzov with his staff and all of us count for nothing. Everything is now centered round the Emperor. So we will go to Dolgorukov. I have to go there anyhow, and I've already spoken to him about you. We shall see whether he cannot attach you to himself or find a place for you somewhere nearer the sun." Prince Andrew always became specially keen when he had to guide a young man and help him to worldly success. Under cover of obtaining help of this kind for another, which from pride he would never accept for himself, he kept in touch with the circle which confers success and which attracted him. He very readily took up Boris's cause and went with him to Dolgorukov. It was late in the evening when they entered the palace at Olmütz, occupied by the emperors and their retinues. That same day, a council of war had been held, in which all the members of the Hofkriegsrat and both emperors took part. At that council, contrary to the views of the old generals Kutuzov and Prince Schwarzenberg, it had been decided to advance immediately and give battle to Bonaparte. The council of war was just over when Prince Andrew, accompanied by Boris, arrived at the palace to find Dolgorukov. Everyone at headquarters was still under the spell of the day's council, at which the party of the young had triumphed. The voices of those who counseled delay and advised waiting for something else before advancing had been so completely silenced, and their arguments confuted by such conclusive evidence of the advantages of attacking, that what had been discussed at the council, the coming battle and the victory that would certainly result from it, no longer seemed to be in the future, but in the past. All the advantages were on our side. Our enormous forces, undoubtedly superior to Napoleon's, were concentrated in one place. The troops, inspired by the Emperor's presence, were eager for action. The strategic position where the operations would take place was familiar in all its details to the Austrian general Weyrother. A lucky accident had ordained that the Austrian army should maneuver the previous year on the very fields where the French had now to be fought. The adjacent locality was known and shown in every detail on the maps, and Bonaparte, evidently weakened, was undertaking nothing. Dolgorukov, one of the warmest advocates of an attack, had just returned from the council, tired and exhausted, but eager and proud of the victory that had been gained. Prince Andrew introduced his protégé, but Prince Dolgorukov, politely and firmly pressing his hand, said nothing to Boris, and, evidently unable to suppress the thoughts which were uppermost in his mind at that moment, addressed Prince Andrew in French. "Ah, my dear fellow, what a battle we have gained! God grant that the one that will result from it will be as victorious. However, my dear fellow," he said abruptly and eagerly, "I must confess to having been unjust to the Austrians, and especially to Weyrother. What exactitude, what minuteness, what knowledge of the locality, what foresight for every eventuality, every possibility, even to the smallest detail. No, my dear fellow, no conditions better than our present ones could have been devised. This combination of Austrian precision with Russian valor, what more could be wished for?" "So the attack is definitely resolved on?" Bolkonski asked Dolgorukov. "And do you know, my dear fellow, it seems to me that Bonaparte has decidedly lost his bearings. You know that a letter was received from him today for the Emperor." Dolgorukov smiled significantly. "Is that so? And what did he say?" inquired Bolkonski. "What can he say? Tradiridira and so on, merely to gain time. I tell you, he's in our hands, that's certain. But what was most amusing," he continued with a sudden good-natured laugh, "was that we could not think how to address the reply, if not as consul, and of course not as emperor. It seemed to me it should be to General Bonaparte." "But between not recognizing him as emperor and calling him General Bonaparte, there is a difference," remarked Bolkonski. "That's just it," interrupted Dolgorukov, quickly laughing. "You know, Bilibin, he's a very clever fellow. He suggested addressing him as usurper and enemy of mankind." Dolgorukov laughed merrily. "Only that?" said Bolkonski. "All the same, it was Bilibin who found a suitable form for the address. He's a wise and clever fellow." "What was it?" "To the head of the French government." "Au chef du gouvernement français," said Dolgorukov with grave satisfaction. "Good, wasn't it?"
"Yes, but he will dislike it extremely," said Bolkonski.
"Oh, yes, very much. My brother knows him. He's dined with him, the present emperor, more than once in Paris, and tells me he never met a more cunning or subtle diplomatist. You know, a combination of French adroitness and Italian play-acting. Do you know the tale about him and Count Markov? Count Markov was the only man who knew how to handle him. You know the story of the handkerchief? It's delightful." And the talkative Dolgorukov, turning now to Boris, now to Prince Andrew, told how Bonaparte, wishing to test Markov, our ambassador, purposely dropped a handkerchief in front of him and stood looking at Markov, probably expecting Markov to pick it up for him, and how Markov immediately dropped his own beside it and picked it up without touching Bonaparte's.
"Delightful," said Bolkonski. "But I've come to you, Prince, as a petitioner on behalf of this young man. You see..." But before Prince Andrew could finish, an aide-de-camp came in to summon Dolgorukov to the Emperor.
"Oh, what a nuisance," said Dolgorukov, getting up hurriedly and pressing the hands of Prince Andrew and Boris. "You know, I should be very glad to do all in my power, both for you and for this dear young man." Again he pressed the hand of the latter with an expression of good-natured, sincere, and animated levity. "But, you see, another time." Boris was excited by the thought of being so close to the higher powers as he felt himself to be at that moment. He was conscious that here he was in contact with the springs that set in motion the enormous movements of the mass of which, in his regiment, he felt himself a tiny, obedient, and insignificant atom. They followed Prince Dolgorukov out into the corridor and met, coming out of the door of the Emperor's room by which Dolgorukov had entered,
A short man in civilian clothes, with a clever face and sharply projecting jaw, which, without spoiling his face, gave him a peculiar vivacity and shiftiness of expression. This short man nodded to Dolgorukov as to an intimate friend, and stared at Prince Andrew with cool intensity, walking straight toward him, and evidently expecting him to bow or to step out of his way. Prince Andrew did neither. A look of animosity appeared on his face, and the other turned away and went down the side of the corridor. "Who was that?" asked Boris.
"He's one of the most remarkable, but to me most unpleasant of men, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Prince Adam Czartoryski. It is such men as he who decide the fate of nations," added Bolkonski with a sigh that he could not suppress as they passed out of the palace.
Next day, the army began its campaign, and up to the very Battle of Austerlitz, Boris was unable to see either Prince Andrew or Dolgorukov again, and remained for a while with the Ismailov regiment. Chapter 9. Nicholas not in the action at Wieschau. The Emperor. Nicholas's devotion to him. At dawn on the 16th of November, Denisov's squadron, in which Nicholas Rostov served, and which was in Prince Bagration's detachment, moved from the place where it had spent the night, advancing into action as arranged, and after going behind other columns for about two-thirds of a mile, was stopped on the high road. Rostov saw the Cossacks, and then the first and second squadrons of hussars and infantry battalions and artillery pass by and go forward, and then Generals Bagration and Dolgorukov ride past with their adjutants. All the fear before action which he had experienced as previously, all the inner struggle to conquer that fear, all his dreams of distinguishing himself as a true hussar in this battle had been wasted. Their squadron remained in reserve, and Nicholas Rostov spent that day in a dull and wretched mood. At 9 in the morning, he heard firing in front and shouts of hurrah, and saw wounded being brought back. There were not many of them. And at last he saw how a whole detachment of French cavalry was brought in, convoyed by a sotnya of Cossacks, a squadron of 100 cavalrymen. Evidently, the affair was over, and, though not big, had been a successful engagement. The men and officers returning spoke of a brilliant victory, of the occupation of the town of Wieschau, and the capture of a whole French squadron. The day was bright and sunny after a sharp night frost, and the cheerful glitter of that autumn day was in keeping with the news of victory, which was conveyed not only by the tales of those who had taken part in it, but also by the joyful expression on the faces of soldiers, officers, generals, and adjutants as they passed Rostov, going or coming. And Nicholas, who had vainly suffered all the dread that precedes a battle, and had spent that happy day in inactivity, was all the more depressed.
"Come here, Rostov! Let's drink to drown our grief!" shouted Denisov, who had settled down by the roadside with a flask and some food.
The officers gathered round Denisov's canteen, eating and talking.
"There, they're bringing another,"
cried one of the officers, indicating a captive French dragoon who was being brought in on foot by two Cossacks. One of them was leading by the bridle a fine large French horse he had taken from the prisoner.
"Sell us that horse," Denisov called out to the Cossacks. "If you like, Your Honor."
The officers got up and stood round the Cossacks and their prisoner. The French dragoon was a young Alsatian who spoke French with a German accent. He was breathless with agitation, his face was red, and when he heard some French spoken, he at once began speaking to the officers, addressing first one, then another. He said he would not have been taken, it was not his fault, but the corporals, who had sent him to seize some horse cloths, though he had told him the Russians were there. And at every word he added, "But don't hurt my little horse," and stroked the animal. It was plain that he did not quite grasp where he was. Now he excused himself for having been taken prisoner, and now, imagining himself before his own officers, insisted on his soldierly discipline and zeal in the service. He brought with him into our rear guard all the freshness of atmosphere of the French army, which was so alien to us. The Cossack sold the horse for 2 gold pieces, and Rostov, being the richest of the officers, now that he had received his money, bought it. "But don't hurt my little horse," said the Alsatian good-naturedly to Rostov when the animal was handed over to the hussar. Rostov smilingly reassured the dragoon and gave him money.
"Allez, allez," said the Cossack, touching the prisoner's arm to make him go on.
"The Emperor! The Emperor!" was suddenly heard among the hussars. All began to run and bustle, and Rostov saw coming up the road behind him several riders with white plumes in their hats. In a moment, everyone was in his place, waiting. Rostov did not know or remember how he ran to his place and mounted. Instantly, his regret at not having been in action and his dejected mood amid people of whom he was weary had gone. Instantly, every thought of himself had vanished. He was filled with happiness at his nearness to the Emperor. He felt that this nearness by itself made up to him for the day he had lost. He was happy as a lover when the longed-for moment of meeting arrives. Not daring to look round, and without looking round, he was ecstatically conscious of his approach. He felt it not only from the sound of the hoofs of the approaching cavalcade, but because as he drew near, everything grew brighter, more joyful, more significant, and more festive around him. Nearer and nearer to Rostov came that sun, shedding beams of mild and majestic light around, and already he felt himself enveloped in those beams. He heard his voice, that kindly, calm, and majestic voice that was yet so simple. And as if in accord with Rostov's feeling, there was a deathly stillness amid which was heard the Emperor's voice.
"The Pavlograd Hussars?" he inquired.
"The reserve, sire," replied a voice, a very human one compared to that which had said the Pavlograd Hussars. The Emperor drew level with Rostov and halted. Alexander's face was even more beautiful than it had been 3 days before at the review. It shone with such gaiety and youth, such innocent youth, that it suggested the liveliness of a 14-year-old boy. And yet it was the face of the majestic Emperor. Casually, while surveying the squadron, the Emperor's eyes met Rostov's and rested on them for not more than 2 seconds. Whether or no the Emperor understood what was going on in Rostov's soul, it seemed to Rostov that he understood everything. At any rate, his light blue eyes gazed for about 2 seconds into Rostov's face. A gentle, mild light poured from them. Then all at once he raised his eyebrows, abruptly touched his horse with his left foot, and galloped on. The young Emperor could not restrain his wish to be present at the battle, and, in spite of the remonstrances of his courtiers, at 12 o'clock left the third column with which he had been and galloped toward the vanguard. Before he came up with the hussars, several adjutants met him with news of the successful result of the action. This battle, which consisted in the capture of a French squadron, was represented as a brilliant victory over the French, and so the Emperor and the whole army, especially while the smoke hung over the battlefield, believed that the French had been defeated and were retreating against their will. A few minutes after the Emperor had passed, the Pavlograd division was ordered to advance. In Wischau itself, a petty German town, Rostov saw the Emperor again. In the marketplace, where there had been some rather heavy firing before the Emperor's arrival, lay several killed and wounded soldiers, whom there had not been time to move. The Emperor, surrounded by his suite of officers and courtiers, was riding a bob-tailed chestnut mare, a different one from that which he had ridden at the review, and, bending to one side, he gracefully held a gold lorgnette to his eyes and looked at a soldier who lay prone, with blood on his uncovered head. The wounded soldier was so dirty, coarse, and revolting that his proximity to the Emperor shocked Rostov. Rostov saw how the Emperor's rather round shoulders shuddered, as if a cold shiver had run down them, how his left foot began convulsively tapping the horse's side with the spur, and how the well-trained horse looked round unconcerned and did not stir. An adjutant, dismounting, lifted the soldier under the arm to place him on a stretcher that had been brought. The soldier groaned.
"Gently, gently. Can't you do it more gently?" said the Emperor, apparently suffering more than the dying soldier. And he rode away.
Rostov saw tears filling the Emperor's eyes and heard him as he was riding away say to Czartoryski, "What a terrible thing war is. What a terrible thing. Quelle terrible chose que la guerre." The troops of the vanguard were stationed before Wischau within sight of the enemy's lines, which all day long had yielded ground to us at the least firing. The Emperor's gratitude was announced to the vanguard, rewards were promised, and the men received a double ration of vodka. The campfires crackled, and the soldiers' songs resounded even more merrily than on the previous night. Denisov celebrated his promotion to the rank of major, and Rostov, who had already drunk enough, at the end of the feast proposed the Emperor's health. "Not our sovereign the Emperor, as they say at official dinners," said he, "but the health of our sovereign, that good, enchanting, and great man. Let us drink to his health and to the certain defeat of the French." "If we fought before," he said, "not letting the French pass, as at Schöngraben, what shall we not do now when he is at the front? We will all die for him gladly. Is it not so, gentlemen? Perhaps I'm not saying it right. I've drunk a great deal, but that is how I feel, and so do you too. To the health of Alexander the First! Hurrah! Hurrah!" rang the enthusiastic voices of the officers. And the old cavalry captain Kirsten shouted enthusiastically, and no less sincerely than the 20-year-old Rostov. When the officers had emptied and smashed their glasses, Kirsten filled others, and in shirt sleeves and breeches went glass in hand to the soldiers' bonfires, and with his long gray moustache, his white chest showing under his open shirt, he stood in a majestic pose in the light of the campfire, waving his uplifted arm. "Lads, here's to our sovereign the Emperor, and victory over our enemies! Hurrah!" he exclaimed in his dashing old hussar's baritone. The hussars crowded round and responded heartily with loud shouts. Late that night, when all had separated, Denisov, with his short hand, patted his favorite Rostov on the shoulder. "As there's no one to fall in love with on campaign, he's fallen in love with the Tsar," he said. "Denisov, don't make fun of it," cried Rostov. "It is such a lofty, beautiful feeling, such a..." I believe it, friend, and I share and approve." "No, you don't understand." And Rostov got up and went wandering among the campfires, dreaming of what happiness it would be to die, not in saving the Emperor's life, he did not even dare to dream of that, but simply to die before his eyes. He really was in love with the Tsar and the glory of the Russian arms and the hope of future triumph. And he was not the only man to experience that feeling during those memorable days preceding the Battle of Austerlitz. 9/10 of the men in the Russian army were then in love, though less ecstatically, with their Tsar and the glory of the Russian arms. Chapter 10. Preparations for Action. Dolgorukov's opinion of Napoleon and of his position. Kutuzov's depression. The next day the Emperor stopped at Wieschau, and Villiers, his physician, was repeatedly summoned to see him. At headquarters and among the troops nearby, the news spread that the Emperor was unwell. He ate nothing and had slept badly that night, those around him reported. The cause of this indisposition was the strong impression made on his sensitive mind by the sight of the killed and wounded. At daybreak on the 17th, a French officer who had come with a flag of truce demanding an audience with the Russian Emperor was brought into Wieschau from our outposts. This officer was Savary. The Emperor had only just fallen asleep, and so Savary had to wait. At midday he was admitted to the Emperor, and an hour later he rode off with Prince Dolgorukov to the advanced post of the French army. It was rumored that Savary had been sent to propose to Alexander a meeting with Napoleon. To the joy and pride of the whole army, a personal interview was refused, and instead of the sovereign, Prince Dolgorukov, the victor at Wieschau, was sent with Savary to negotiate with Napoleon, if, contrary to expectations, these negotiations were actuated by a real desire for peace. Toward evening, Dolgorukov came back, went straight to the Tsar, and remained alone with him for a long time. On the 18th and 19th of November, the army advanced 2 days' march, and the enemy's outposts, after a brief interchange of shots, retreated. In the highest army circles, from midday on the 19th, a great, excitedly bustling activity began, which lasted till the morning of the 20th, when the memorable Battle of Austerlitz was fought. Till midday on the 19th, the activity, the eager talk, running to and fro, and dispatching of adjutants, was confined to the Emperor's headquarters. But on the afternoon of that day, This activity reached Kutuzov's headquarters and the staffs of the commanders of columns. By evening, the adjutants had spread it to all ends and parts of the army, and in the night from the 19th to the 20th, the whole 80,000 allied troops rose from their bivouacs to the hum of voices, and the army swayed and started in one enormous mass 6 miles long. The concentrated activity which had begun at the Emperor's headquarters in the morning and had started the whole movement that followed was like the first movement of the main wheel of a large tower clock. One wheel slowly moved, another was set in motion, and a third, and wheels began to revolve faster and faster, levers and cogwheels to work, chimes to play, figures to pop out, and the hands to advance with regular motion as a result of all that activity. Just as in the mechanism of a clock, so in the mechanism of the military machine, an impulse once given leads to the final result. And just as indifferently quiescent, till the moment when motion is transmitted to them, are the parts of the mechanism which the impulse has not yet reached. Wheels creak on their axles as the cogs engage one another, and the revolving pulleys whir with the rapidity of their movement. But a neighboring wheel is as quiet and motionless as though it were prepared to remain so for 100 years. But the moment comes when the lever catches it, and obeying the impulse, that wheel begins to creak and joins in the common motion, the result and aim of which are beyond its ken. Just as in a clock, the result of the complicated motion of innumerable wheels and pulleys is merely a slow and regular movement of the hands which show the time, so the result of all the complicated human activities of 160,000 Russians and French, all their passions, desires, remorse, humiliations, sufferings, outbursts of pride, fear, and enthusiasm, was only the loss of the Battle of Austerlitz, the so-called Battle of the Three Emperors. That is to say, a slow movement of the hand on the dial of human history. Prince Andrew was on duty that day and in constant attendance on the commander-in-chief. At 6 in the evening, Kutuzov went to the Emperor's headquarters and, after staying but a short time with the Tsar, went to see the Grand Marshal of the court, Count Tolstoy. Bolkonski took the opportunity to go in to get some details of the coming action from Dolgorukov. He felt that Kutuzov was upset and dissatisfied about something, and that at headquarters they were dissatisfied with him, and also that at the Emperor's headquarters everyone adopted toward him the tone of men who know something others do not know. He therefore wished to speak to Dolgorukov.
"Well, how do you do, my dear fellow?" said Dolgorukov, who was sitting at tea with Bilibin. "The fete is for tomorrow. How is your old fellow? Out of sorts?"
"I won't say he's out of sorts, but I fancy he would like to be heard."
"But they heard him at the Council of War, and will hear him when he talks sense. But to temporize and wait for something, now when Bonaparte fears nothing so much as a general battle, is impossible."
"Yes, you have seen him?" said Prince Andrew. "Well, what is Bonaparte like? How did he impress you?"
"Yes, I saw him, and am convinced that he fears nothing so much as a general engagement," repeated Dolgorukov, evidently prizing this general conclusion which he had arrived at from his interview with Napoleon. "If he weren't afraid of a battle, why did he ask for that interview? Why negotiate, and above all, why retreat, when to retreat is so contrary to his method of conducting war? Believe me, he is afraid of a general battle. His hour has come. Mark my words."
"But tell me, what is he like, eh?" said Prince Andrew again.
"He is a man in a grey overcoat, very anxious that I should call him Your Majesty, but who, to his chagrin, got no title from me. That's the sort of man he is, and nothing more," replied Dolgorukov, looking round at Bilibin with a smile. "Despite my great respect for old Kutuzov," he continued, "we should be a nice set of fellows if we were to wait about and so give him a chance to escape or to trick us, now that we certainly have him in our hands. No, we mustn't forget Suvorov and his rule. Not to put yourself in a position to be attacked, but yourself to attack. Believe me, in war, the energy of young men often shows the way better than all the experience of old cunctators." Note, cunctator, the delayer,
a nickname given to Quintus Fabius Maximus Verrucosus because of his cautious military tactics. But in what position are we going to attack him? I've been at the outposts today, and it is impossible to say where his chief forces are situated, said Prince Andrew. He wished to explain to Dolgorukov a plan of attack he had himself formed. Oh, that's all the same, Dolgorukov said quickly, and getting up he spread a map on the table. All eventualities have been foreseen. If he is standing before Brünn, and Prince Dolgorukov rapidly but indistinctly explained Weyrother's plan of a flanking movement. Prince Andrew began to reply and to state his own plan, which might have been as good as Weyrother's, but for the disadvantage that Weyrother's had already been approved. As soon as Prince Andrew began to demonstrate the defects of the latter and the merits of his own plan, Prince Dolgorukov ceased to listen to him and gazed absent-mindedly not at the map, but at Prince Andrew's face. There will be a council of war at Kutuzov's tonight, though. You can say all this there, remarked Dolgorukov. I will do so, said Prince Andrew, moving away from the map. Whatever are you bothering about, gentlemen, said Bilibin, who till then had listened with an amused smile to their conversation and now was evidently ready with a joke. Whether tomorrow brings victory or defeat, the glory of our Russian arms is secure. Except your Kutuzov, there is not a single Russian in command of a column. The commanders are Herr General Wimpfen, Le Comte de Langeron, Le Prince de Liechtenstein, Le Prince de Hohenlohe, and finally Prisch-Prisch, and so on, like all those Polish names. Be quiet, backbiter, said Dolgorukov. It is not true. There are now two Russians, Miloradovich and Dokhturov, and there would be a third, Count Arakcheyev, if his nerves were not too weak. However, I think General Kutuzov has come out, said Prince Andrew. I wish you good luck and success, gentlemen, he added, and went out after shaking hands with Dolgorukov and Bilibin. On the way home, Prince Andrew could not refrain from asking Kutuzov, who was sitting silently beside him, what he thought of tomorrow's battle. Kutuzov looked sternly at his adjutant, and after a pause replied, I think the battle will be lost. And so I told Count Tolstoy, and asked him to tell the Emperor. What do you think he replied? But, my dear general, I am engaged with rice and cutlets. Look after military matters yourself. Yes. That was the answer I got. Chapter 11. The Council of War. Weyrother's plans. Kutuzov sleeps. Prince Andrew's reflection. Shortly after 9 o'clock that evening, Weyrother drove with his plans to Kutuzov's quarters where the Council of War was to be held. All the commanders of columns were summoned to the commander-in-chief's, and with the exception of Prince Bagration, who declined to come, were all there at the appointed time. Weyrother, who was in full control of the proposed battle, by his eagerness and briskness presented a marked contrast to the dissatisfied and drowsy Kutuzov, who reluctantly played the part of chairman and president of the Council of War. Weyrother evidently felt himself to be at the head of a movement that had already become unrestrainable. He was like a horse running downhill harnessed to a heavy cart. Whether he was pulling it or being pushed by it, he did not know, but rushed along at headlong speed, with no time to consider what this movement might lead to. Weyrother had been twice that evening to the enemy's picket line to reconnoiter personally, and twice to the Emperor's, Russian and Austrian, to report and explain, and to his headquarters, where he had dictated the dispositions in German, and now, much exhausted, he arrived at Kutuzov's. He was evidently so busy that he even forgot to be polite to the commander-in-chief. He interrupted him, talked rapidly and indistinctly without looking at the man he was addressing, and did not reply to questions put to him. He was bespattered with mud and had a pitiful, weary, and distracted air, though at the same time he was haughty and self-confident. Kutuzov was occupying a nobleman's castle of modest dimensions near Austerlitz. In the large drawing-room, which had become the commander-in-chief's office, were gathered Kutuzov himself, Weyrother, and the members of the Council of War. They were drinking tea and only awaited Prince Bagration to begin the council. At last Bagration's orderly came with the news that the prince could not attend. Prince Andrew came in to inform the commander-in-chief of this, and availing himself of permission previously given him by Kutuzov to be present at the council, He remained in the room.
"Since Prince Bagration is not coming, we may begin," said Bayreuther, hurriedly rising from his seat and going up to the table on which an enormous map of the environs of Brünn was spread out. Kutuzov, with his uniform unbuttoned so that his fat neck bulged over his collar as if escaping, was sitting almost asleep in a low chair with his podgy old hands resting symmetrically on its arms. At the sound of Bayreuther's voice, he opened his one eye with an effort.
"Yes, yes, if you please. It is already late," said he. And nodding his head, he let it droop and again closed his eye.
If at first the members of the council thought that Kutuzov was pretending to sleep, the sounds his nose emitted during the reading that followed proved that the commander-in-chief at that moment was absorbed by a far more serious matter than a desire to show his contempt for the dispositions or anything else. He was engaged in satisfying the irresistible human need for sleep. He really was asleep. Bayreuther, with the gesture of a man too busy to lose a moment, glanced at Kutuzov, and having convinced himself that he was asleep, took up a paper and in a loud, monotonous voice began to read out the dispositions for the impending battle, under a heading which he also read out. "Dispositions for an attack on the enemy position behind Kobylnitz and Sokolnitz, November 30th, 1805. Note, Bayreuther was reading in German and employed the new style calendar, so that these dispositions were drawn up on November 18th, old style. The dispositions were very complicated and difficult. They began as follows. "As the enemy's left wing rests on wooded hills, and his right extends along Kobylnitz and Sokolnitz behind the ponds that are there, while we, on the other hand, with our left wing by far outflank his right, it is advantageous to attack the enemy's latter wing, especially if we occupy the villages of Sokolnitz and Kobylnitz, whereby we can both fall on his flank and pursue him over the plain between Schlapanitz and the Thürasser Forest, avoiding the defiles of Schlapanitz and Belowitz, which cover the enemy's front. For this object, it is necessary that the first column marches, the second column marches, the third column marches, and so on," read Bayreuther. The general seemed to listen reluctantly to the difficult dispositions. The tall, fair-haired General Buxhoeven stood leaning his back against the wall, his eyes fixed on a burning candle, and seemed not to listen or even to wish to be thought to listen. Exactly opposite Bayreuther, with his glistening, wide-open eyes fixed upon him and his moustache twisted upwards, sat the ruddy Miloradovich in a military pose, his elbows turned outwards, his hands on his knees, and his shoulders raised. He remained stubbornly silent, gazing at Vairota's face, and only turned away his eyes when the Austrian chief of staff finished reading. Then Miloradovich looked round significantly at the other generals, but one could not tell from that significant look whether he agreed or disagreed, and was satisfied or not with the arrangements. Next to Vairota sat Count Langeron, who, with a subtle smile that never left his typically southern French face during the whole time of the reading, gazed at his delicate fingers, which rapidly twirled by its corners a gold snuff-box on which was a portrait. In the middle of one of the longest sentences, he stopped the rotary motion of the snuff-box, raised his head, and, with inimical politeness lurking in the corners of his thin lips, interrupted Bayreuther, wishing to say something. But the Austrian general, continuing to read, frowned angrily and jerked his elbows as if to say, "You can tell me your views later, but now be so good as to look at the map and listen." Langeron lifted his eyes with an expression of perplexity, turned round to Miloradovich as if seeking an explanation, but meeting the latter's impressive but meaningless gaze, drooped his eyes sadly, and again took to twirling his snuff-box. "A geography lesson," he muttered as if to himself, but loud enough to be heard. Przebyszewski, with respectful but dignified politeness, held his hand to his ear toward Bayreuther with the air of a man absorbed in attention. Dokhturov, a little man, sat opposite Bayreuther with an assiduous and modest mien, and, stooping over the outspread map, conscientiously studied the dispositions and the unfamiliar locality. He asked Bayreuther several times to repeat words he had not clearly heard, and the difficult names of villages.
Vyrota complied, and Dokhturov noted them down. When the reading, which lasted more than an hour, was over, Langeron again brought his snuff-box to rest, and without looking at Vyrota or at anyone in particular, began to say how difficult it was to carry out such a plan in which the enemy's position was assumed to be known, whereas it was perhaps not known, since the enemy was in movement. Langeron's objections were valid, but it was obvious that their chief aim was to show General Vyrota, who had read his dispositions with as much self-confidence as if he were addressing schoolchildren, that he had to do not with fools, but with men who could teach him something in military matters. When the monotonous sound of Vyrota's voice ceased, Kutuzov opened his eye, as a miller wakes up when the soporific drone of the mill wheel is interrupted. He listened to what Langeron said, as if remarking, "So you're still at that silly business," quickly closed his eye again, and let his head sink still lower. Langeron, trying as virulently as possible to sting Vyrota's vanity as author of the military plan, argued that Bonaparte might easily attack instead of being attacked, and so render the whole of this plan perfectly worthless. Vyrota met all objections with a firm and contemptuous smile, evidently prepared beforehand to meet all objections, be they what they might. "If he could attack us, he would have done so today," said he. "So you think he is powerless?" said Langeron. "He has 40,000 men at most," replied Vyrota, with the smile of a doctor to whom an old wife wishes to explain the treatment of a case. "In that case, he is inviting his doom by awaiting our attack," said Langeron, with a subtly ironical smile, again glancing round for support to Miloradovich, who was near him. But Miloradovich was at that moment evidently thinking of anything rather than of what the generals were disputing about. "Ma foi," said he, "tomorrow we shall see all that on the battlefield." Vyrota again gave that smile which seemed to say that to him it was strange and ridiculous to meet objections from Russian generals and to have to prove to them what he had not merely convinced himself of, but had also convinced the sovereign emperors of. "The enemy has quenched his fires, and a continual noise is heard from his camp," said he. "What does that mean? Either he is retreating, which is the only thing we need fear, or he is changing his position." He smiled ironically. "But even if he also took up a position in the Turasa, he merely saves us a great deal of trouble, and all our arrangements to the minutest detail remain the same." "How is that?" began Prince Andrew, who had for long been waiting an opportunity to express his doubts. Kutuzov here woke up, coughed heavily, and looked round at the generals. "Gentlemen, the dispositions for tomorrow, or rather for today, for it is past midnight, cannot now be altered," said he. "You have heard them, and we shall all do our duty. But before a battle, there is nothing more important," he paused, "than to have a good sleep." He moved as if to rise. The generals bowed and retired. It was past midnight. Prince Andrew went out. The council of war, at which Prince Andrew had not been able to express his opinion as he had hoped to, left on him a vague and uneasy impression. Whether Dolgorukov and Vyrota, or Kutuzov, Langeron, and the others who did not approve of the plan of attack were right, he did not know. But was it really not possible for Kutuzov to state his views plainly to the emperor? Is it possible that on account of court and personal considerations, tens of thousands of lives? And my life, he thought, must be risked. Yes, it is very likely that I shall be killed tomorrow, he thought. And suddenly, at this thought of death, a whole series of most distant, most intimate memories rose in his imagination. He remembered his last parting from his father and his wife. He remembered the days when he first loved her. He thought of her pregnancy and felt sorry for her and for himself. And in a nervously emotional and softened mood, he went out of the hut in which he was billeted with Nesvitsky and began to walk up and down before it. The night was foggy, and through the fog the moonlight gleamed mysteriously. Yes, tomorrow, tomorrow, he thought. Tomorrow everything may be over for me. All these memories will be no more. None of them will have any meaning for me. Tomorrow, perhaps, even certainly, I have a presentiment that for the first time I shall have to show all I can do. And his fancy pictured the battle, its loss, the concentration of fighting at one point, and the hesitation of all the commanders. And then that happy moment, that Toulon for which he had so long waited, presents itself to him at last. He firmly and clearly expresses his opinion to Kutuzov, to Weyrother, and to the emperors. All are struck by the justness of his views, but no one undertakes to carry them out, so he takes a regiment, a division, stipulates that no one is to interfere with his arrangements, leads his division to the decisive point, and gains the victory alone. But death and suffering? Suggested another voice. Prince Andrew, however, did not answer that voice, and went on dreaming of his triumphs. The dispositions for the next battle are planned by him alone. Nominally, he is only an adjutant on Kutuzov's staff, but he does everything alone. The next battle is won by him alone. Kutuzov is removed, and he is appointed. Well, and then? Asked the other voice. If before that you are not 10 times wounded, killed, or betrayed, well, what then? Well, then, Prince Andrew answered himself, I don't know what will happen and don't want to know and can't. But if I want this, want glory, want to be known to men, want to be loved by them, it is not my fault that I want it and want nothing but that and live only for that. Yes, for that alone. I shall never tell anyone. But, oh God, what am I to do if I love nothing but fame and men's esteem? Death, wounds, the loss of family, I fear nothing. And precious and dear as many persons are to me, father, sister, wife, those dearest to me, yet, dreadful and unnatural as it seems, I would give them all at once for a moment of glory, of triumph over men, of love from men I don't know and never shall know. For the love of these men here, he thought, as he listened to voices in Kutuzov's courtyard. The voices were those of the orderlies who were packing up. One voice, probably a coachman's, was teasing Kutuzov's old cook, whom Prince Andrew knew and who was called Tit. He was saying, Tit, I say, Tit. Well, returned the old man. Go, Tit, thresh a bit, said the wag. Oh, go to the devil, called out a voice, drowned by the laughter of the orderlies and servants. All the same, I love and value nothing but triumph over them all. I value this mystic power and glory that is floating here above me in this mist. Chapter 12. Rostov at the Front. Visit of Bagration and Dolgorukov. Rostov sent to reconnoiter. Napoleon's proclamation. That same night, Rostov was with a platoon on skirmishing duty in front of Bagration's detachment. His hussars were placed along the line in couples, and he himself rode along the line trying to master the sleepiness that kept coming over him. An enormous space, with our army's campfires dimly glowing in the fog, could be seen behind him. In front of him was misty darkness. Rostov could see nothing, peer as he would into that foggy distance. Now something gleamed gray, now there was something black, now little light seemed to glimmer where the enemy ought to be. Now he fancied it was only something in his own eyes. His eyes kept closing, and in his fancy appeared now the emperor, now Denisov, and now Moscow memories. And he again hurriedly opened his eyes and saw close before him the head and ears of the horse he was riding. And sometimes, when he came within 6 paces of them, the black figures of hussars. But in the distance was still the same misty darkness. Why not? It might easily happen, thought Rostov, that the emperor will meet me and give me an order as he would to any other officer. He'll say, go and find out what's there. There are many stories of his getting to know an officer in just such a chance way and attaching him to himself. What if he gave me a place near him? Oh, how I would guard him, how I would tell him the truth, how I would unmask his deceivers. And in order to realize vividly his love and devotion to the sovereign, Rostóv pictured to himself an enemy or a deceitful German whom he would not only kill with pleasure, but whom he would slap in the face before the emperor. Suddenly, a distant shout aroused him. He started and opened his eyes. Where am I? Oh, yes, in the skirmishing line. Pass and watchword, Schaft Olmütz. What a nuisance that our squadron will be in reserve tomorrow, he thought. I'll ask leave to go to the front. This may be my only chance of seeing the emperor. It won't be long now before I'm off duty. I'll take another turn, and when I get back, I'll go to the general and ask him. He readjusted himself in the saddle and touched up his horse to ride once more around his hussars. It seemed to him that it was getting lighter. To the left he saw a sloping descent lit up, and facing it a black knoll that seemed as steep as a wall. On this knoll there was a white patch that Rostóv could not at all make out. Was it a glade in the wood lit up by the moon, or some unmelted snow, or some white houses? He even thought something moved on that white spot. I expect it's snow. That spot, a spot in Tash, he thought. There now, it's not a Tash. Natasha, sister, black eyes. Natasha. Won't you be surprised when I tell her how I've seen the emperor? Natasha, take my saber, Tash. Keep to your right, Your Honor. There are bushes here, came the voice of an hussar, past whom Rostóv was riding in the act of falling asleep. Rostóv lifted his head that had sunk almost to his horse's mane and pulled up beside the hussar. He was succumbing to irresistible, youthful, childish drowsiness. But what was I thinking? I mustn't forget. How shall I speak to the emperor? No, that's not it. That's tomorrow. Oh, yes, Natasha, Sabertash. Sabre them. Whom? The hussars. Ah, the hussars with moustaches. Along the Tverskaya street rode the hussar with moustaches. I thought about him, too, just opposite Guryev's house. Oh, Guryev. Oh, but Denisov's a fine fellow. But that's all nonsense. The chief thing is that the emperor is here. How he looked at me and wished to say something, but dared not. No, it was I who dared not. But that's nonsense. The chief thing is not to forget the important thing I was thinking of. Yes. Natasha. Sabotage. Oh, yes, that's right. And his head once more sank to his horse's neck. All at once it seemed to him that he was being fired at. What? Cut them down. What? Said Rostóv, waking up. At the moment he opened his eyes, he heard in front of him, where the enemy was, the long-drawn shouts of thousands of voices. His horse and the horse of the hussar near him pricked their ears at these shouts. Over there, where the shouting came from, a fire flared up and went out again, then another. And all along the French line on the hill, fires flared up, and the shouting grew louder and louder. Rostóv could hear the sound of French words, but could not distinguish them. The din of many voices was too great. All he could hear was, ah, and roar. What's that? What do you make of it? Said Rostóv to the hussar beside him. That must be the enemy's camp. The hussar did not reply. Why, don't you hear it? Rostóv asked again after waiting for a reply.
Who can tell, Your Honor? Replied the hussar reluctantly.
From the direction, it must be the enemy, repeated Rostóv.
It may be he, or it may be nothing, muttered the hussar. It's dark. Steady, he cried to his fidgeting horse.
Rostov's horse was also getting restive. It pawed the frozen ground, pricking its ears at the noise and looking at the lights. The shouting grew still louder and merged into a general roar that only an army of several thousand men could produce.
The lights spread farther and farther, probably along the line of the French camp. Rostov no longer wanted to sleep. The gay, triumphant shouting of the enemy army had a stimulating effect on him. "Vive l'Empereur! L'Empereur!" he now heard distinctly. "They can't be far off. Probably just beyond the stream," he said to the hussar beside him. The hussar only sighed without replying and coughed angrily. The sound of horses' hoofs approaching at a trot along the line of hussars was heard, and out of the foggy darkness the figure of a sergeant of hussars suddenly appeared, looming huge as an elephant. "Your Honor, the generals," said the sergeant, riding up to Rostov. Rostov, still looking round toward the fires and the shouts, rode with the sergeant to meet some mounted men who were riding along the line. One was on a white horse. Prince Bagration and Prince Dolgorukov, with their adjutants, had come to witness the curious phenomenon of the lights and shouts in the enemy's camp. Rostov rode up to Bagration, reported to him, and then joined the adjutants, listening to what the generals were saying. "Believe me," said Prince Dolgorukov, addressing Bagration, "it is nothing but a trick. He has retreated and ordered the rear guard to kindle fires and make a noise to deceive us." "Hardly," said Bagration. "I saw them this evening on that knoll. If they had retreated, they would have withdrawn from that, too." "Officer," said Bagration to Rostov, "are the enemy's skirmishers still there?"
"They were there this evening, but now I don't know, Your Excellency. Shall I go with some of my hussars to see?" replied Rostov.
Bagration stopped, and before replying tried to see Rostov's face in the mist. "Well, go and see," he said after a pause.
"Yes, sir."
Rostov spurred his horse, called to Sergeant Fyedchenko and two other hussars, told them to follow him, and trotted downhill in the direction from which the shouting came. He felt both frightened and pleased to be riding alone with three hussars into that mysterious and dangerous misty distance where no one had been before him. Bagration called to him from the hill not to go beyond the stream, but Rostov pretended not to hear him and did not stop, but rode on and on, continually mistaking bushes for trees and gullies for men, and continually discovering his mistakes.